You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Gentleman named William Ayers.
Radical college professor William Ayers.
Billy Ayers of the Weather People,
a domestic terrorist group in the 1960s.
He endorses his setting of bombs.
But I also believe that Senator Obama served on a board with Mr. Ayers.
In Mr. Ayers' living,
that's absolutely not true.
Why was Barack Obama involved with William Ayers?
A domestic terrorist.
In the first place.
Pal around with terrorists who targeted their own country.
But you're talking about the equivalent of having a close relationship with Osama bin Laden.
Gentleman named William Ayers.
Osama bin Laden.
Gentleman named William Ayers.
Osama bin Laden.
And I don't care about two washed up old terrorists that are unrepentant about trying to destroy America.
And William Ayers, the man they've been talking about, joins us now. His book, Fugitive Days, Memoirs of an Anti-War Activist, has just been issued in a paperback edition by Beacon Press. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Ayers to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
We just heard a bunch of sound bites indicating how you've been portrayed by the media. Do you recognize yourself in the way that many people have been talking about you?
Not even a little. I'm unrecognizable and unwilling to be recognized in that context.
ABC News described you as John McCain's political piñata. The media narrative established around you basically claimed that you were a domestic terrorist who was unrepentant for his acts. What about that narrative? How inaccurate? I'm sure you feel it's basically inaccurate, but how inaccurate is it?
It's fundamentally inaccurate, top to bottom. I'm not a terrorist, never was a terrorist, and the idea that that label could stick. And interestingly, I don't think it did stick. But I not only never killed or hurt anyone in the years of protest and resistance to the war in Vietnam, but neither did the organization that I co-founded for the 6 years it existed, the Weather Underground. While we were an extreme organization, while we did cross lines of legality, propriety, perhaps even common sense, we did not kill or injure by intention. And the important thing to remember about the Vietnam War, and I was I'm kind of surprised at the way it came up in this campaign, but that was a time of enormous violence. The United States was carrying out a war of terror against an entire population. We were resisting that war for the entire 10 years, and we resisted with every ounce of our being. And yes, we took extreme measures. Yes, we did some vandalism to property, but we never hurt anyone.
Well, there were people who died, not only people within the group, but also there was a killing in Nyack with a bank robbery.
That's true. But again, the Weather Underground came into being in 1970, and it came into being with the death of three of our people, our comrades.
Including one of the guys you made bombs with, Ted Gold, no?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean, the guys that I made bombs with.
Well, I don't know. I thought you at one point were in the book described making bombs with Ted Gold. No.
No. But Ted Gold, Terry Robbins, and Diana Outen were killed in an explosion. In the book, I try to reimagine what might have happened. No one knows what happened, really. But they were obviously involved in building some kind of explosive device. They blew themselves up. And at that point, a small group of us went underground, didn't show up for our trial dates, and went on to, for the next 6 years, to resist the war in Vietnam in that way. And then the organization fell apart. The war ended. The organization fell apart. People went into a lot of different directions. I went to graduate school, and the robbery in Nyack happened after that.
You went into graduate school and went into education.
That's right.
Mark Rudd, who also had been part of the movement, went into education. Is there something about education that attracts former anti-war activists?
Well, I think that there were many things that attracted people: the law, medicine, education. But certainly, it's true that if you think of one of the great struggles going on in our country then and now, it's between militarism, militarization, surveillance, incarceration on the one hand, and then wanting to see resources spent on things like education, healthcare, Social Security, and we were on that side.
Well, how did you make that transition? What did you put on your resume about the lost years when you were applying to college or looking for jobs?
It's funny. There was a New Yorker cartoon just when I surfaced with a guy applying for a job and he's very muscle-bound, and the interviewer is saying, there's a 10-year gap in your resume. And he says, yeah, I was working on my pecs. Well, I wasn't exactly working on my pecs, but I never lied about what happened. I had a 10-year gap in my resume, and what I said was I was an anti-war activist. And people who were interviewing me for jobs at that point, academic jobs, knew something of my history. But the good thing about academia, even though I think academia is fraught with problems, but I think one of the good things is there is no political litmus test for what allows you to become a scholar or to become an active intellectual in that way.
There are all these quotes have been attributed to you. Sarah Palin and John McCain often use a quote of you from the New York Times where you are alleged to have said, I don't regret setting bombs. I feel we didn't do enough. One of the most famous quotes attributed to you from your time with the Weather Underground was, kill all the rich people, break up their cars and apartments, bring the revolution home, kill your parents. That's where it's really at. You've said in interviews you don't remember saying that.
I remember both of those quotes appearing. The one about not regretting setting bombs, I never said that. What I said, the book was released on September 11th, 2001, the hardcover. And
that's bad timing. It was just coincidental.
It was bad timing, but I must say that of all the senses of loss and tragedy of that day, the loss of a book is a pretty small loss, and I never felt personally persecuted or that it was my problem. The country was facing an enormous upheaval and problem, and the book was a small piece of that. But what I said and the theme of every review and every interview in that 2-month period was no regrets, because what I said consistently is what I will say again today, which is I regret many things. I'm 63 years old. I regret a lot of things that we did politically, a lot of things that happened personally. And of course, beginning with the regret of the loss of our three beloved friends. But what I also have said is I don't regret opposing this murderous war in Vietnam with every ounce of my being. I wish we had done more. I still wish we had done more. And frankly, in the war that's going on today, which we know is illegal and immoral and wrong, I wish I could figure out ways to do more.
But a lot of people oppose the war, and they marched in Washington. They tried to storm the Pentagon. Some people got pretty involved, but not in the way that the weather people did.
Well, it's true, but when you say lots of people did lots of things, I did lots of things. I marched in Washington. I stormed the Pentagon. I was arrested many, many times. The first time in October of 1965, when 70% of Americans supported the war. 3 years later, for a variety of reasons that we could talk about, 70% of the American people opposed the war. And I remember when President Lyndon Johnson decided he would not run for re-election, but would rather try to settle the war, we had a spontaneous rally in Ann Arbor and met at the president's house late at night. And he came out to address us, and he said, congratulations, you've won a great victory. Now the war will end. And he believed it, and we believed it. And 5 days later, Martin Luther King was dead. 2 months later, Kennedy was dead. And 2 months after that, Henry Kissinger emerged with a secret plan that would expand the war indefinitely. At that point, people in the anti-war movement splintered. Some joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing. Some went into the communes of Vermont and California. Some fled to Europe and Africa. Some tried to organize in factories. And we did what we did. I don't think anyone in the choices that were made had a clear idea of what would be perfect. And I don't think anyone did the perfect thing.
You were a member of SDS, and then all those different splinter groups occurred, including not just the Weather Underground, but also Lyndon LaRouche, who went in a different direction. So it was a wild time.
It was, and I was a national officer of SDS. I was the education secretary. Mark Rudd was the national secretary. And so, yeah, I was actually, I became the education secretary on a platform of I was too busy being arrested to read a book. So that just shows you kind of where we were at. But I was a national officer of this large student group. And the crisis was we couldn't stop the war. And the crisis for this democracy was we couldn't find a way to stop the war.
But it's interesting to think back to that time. I remember people saying this is going to politicize a whole generation. You had all the rock stars being opposed, writing songs against the war. There was a Herbert Marcuse was being read by half the students in America. None of that happened. In fact, the guy who inspired the title, the Weather Underground, first, I guess, the Weatherman, he wound up becoming rather conservative for a time.
Well, I mean, I don't think...
Bob Dylan.
Yes, of course. I don't think you can... I don't think there's a causal connection necessarily between this event and that event. I do think that people were politicized by the war. They were politicized by the Black Freedom Movement. And so a lot of that hangs on to this day. For example, in March of 2003, I attended the largest anti-war demonstration I ever went on. So there's a lot of kind of romanticizing of the 60s that I think is misplaced. I think that there's a deep anti-war sentiment. I think this recent election, which I think we should all take a minute and celebrate and honor. I think this was the repudiation of the politics of fear and the politics of war without end. I think that's hopeful.
My guest is Bill Ayers, who's written a memoir. In fact, it's called Memoirs of an Anti-War Activist. Fugitive Days is the title. It was released in hardcover on September 11, 2001. Now it's available in paperback from Beacon. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Bill Ayers, whose memoir, Fugitive Days, Memoirs of an Anti-War Activist, has just been released in paperback by Beacon. You pretty much stayed out of the limelight. You remained silent during the presidential campaign, even when people were attacking you. Do you think that you could have said anything that might have neutralized the attacks against you?
I don't. I mean, it's somewhat of a myth to think that I was silent. I was teaching my classes. I was speaking at universities. I spoke at the Adler Institute at a forum that you moderated. So it wasn't that I was silent. What I refused to do was to enter into the soundbite culture and try to interrupt what I took to be a fundamentally dishonest narrative, the narrative that painted me as a demon, somebody to be frightened of, somebody to fear, and that painted a relationship, an imagined relationship with Senator Obama as a way to bring him down. That's the old guilt by association. I wanted to reject it, but I saw no way into it in a kind of one-minute interview.
Well, given that you had known Barack Obama since 1995, did you see this coming after he announced that he was going to run for president?
In some ways, I saw it coming, and in other ways, I was quite surprised by it. I saw the right-wing blogs fill up with this dishonest narrative, and then I saw Fox News pick it up, even though I don't watch it. My kids kept, you know, sending me one clip or another. But I was with my doctoral students at my house having dinner the night that George Stephanopoulos asked Obama about it, and every one of them fell on the floor. They were so shocked, so surprised, and I was too. A couple of weeks later, Sean Hannity had John McCain on and told him the narrative, and McCain said, I don't think we should delve around in the past. It didn't take him long to get on message, but I was surprised at the intensity of it.
It was even picked up by Hillary Clinton
in one of
the debates.
Yes, it was. And in fact, in some ways, I think it's a shameful thing, but I think the Clinton campaign gave the McCain campaign the kind of script to run against Obama on several levels. And the interesting thing is the McCain campaign bought it whole and didn't notice that it defeated Hillary Clinton.
Did anyone from the Obama campaign ever contact you before or during the race?
Never.
It is interesting that many people did give as one of the reasons that they were not going to vote for John McCain, that they felt that it was that the injection of your name into the campaign had really just been seen as dirty politics.
Isn't that a wonderful tribute to people in spite of the kind of yelling and screaming that they were able to say that?
So where were you on election night?
I was in Grant Park for 4 hours, and I wasn't sure we were going to go down there, but I just got swept up in the moment. We went down there, and I was standing in the place in Grant Park where I was arrested and beaten 40 years ago, and you couldn't help but feel what was unimaginable a couple of years ago was now, inevitable and unforgettable.
One of the things that we often hear when people write memoirs is that memory is is a fluid kind of thing, and people will often tell me that when they have compared their memories with other people they're writing about in their book, they find out that they don't always jibe. And you write about that. You talk about the uncertainty of memory. Do you think our culture's collective memory of the 1960s and groups like the Weather Underground is accurate, at least?
I don't. I think actually the mythologizing of the 60s for good and for bad is very much still with us. And while I think this may be the last national campaign that uses the 60s as a kind of bloody shirt, I think that's a good thing mostly, but it's got a bad aspect, which is we've never come to terms with the war in Vietnam, what we really did, what was lost there in terms of purpose and so on. We haven't learned what it means to invade and occupy a country, and we haven't accounted for responsibility. So while I get held up as somebody who was violent, which I reject, I was not violent, Henry Kissinger gets a pass. There's something wrong with that. We ought to really have a truth and reconciliation process if we want to understand what went on.
And you think that this is the last time Vietnam will be brought up, or the 60s, the culture war of the 60s?
You know,
because Barack Obama is somebody who was born after them. He used to point out that he was 8 years old when you were involved in your anti-war activities.
Right. Of course, you know, Stephen Colbert, the great comic, he did The Word one night, and The Word was the 60s. And he began with a clip from Obama saying, "Can't we just get beyond the 60s? And it comes back to a scolding Colbert saying, "No, Senator, we can't. It's the gift that keeps on giving." So in a sense, the right wing likes to keep it alive as a myth of something horrible and terribly amiss and just this side of treasonous. That isn't the true story of the 60s at all.
Well, it is part of the narrative that Bill Clinton got caught up in, and people talked about his getting out of serving in the military, although then when the attempt was made to connect George Bush to something similar, because there were accusations that he had gone AWOL, it didn't hold in that case.
Right. Well,
it didn't work for Al Gore. It didn't work for John Kerry.
That's
why do
true.
You think that is?
Well, I'm not certain why that is, but I think what's interesting is while that history has never been resolved, the other history that's unresolved is the Black Freedom Movement. The mythology of King as a leading a bus boycott, giving a speech, having a dream, getting a Nobel, end of story, is a false story. And part of the reason that Jeremiah Wright was able to be demonized is that we've forgotten the real Martin Luther King, who was a radical, an angry pilgrim. Bernadine Dorn and I have a book coming out next month called Race Course about just this, about the ways in which we've forgotten our memory of the Black Freedom Movement is flawed and way too neat.
What do you think motivated your early involvement in the activism of the 1960s? Was it simply the war?
Well, before the war, it was idealism around the Black Freedom Movement. And I was a student in high school. I was in boarding school. I was drawn to the writings of James Baldwin, which moved me very deeply. I was drawn to the courage and heroism of the Freedom Riders and the lunch counter sit-inners. And I went to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and a whole world opened up. And my eyes opened, and I saw a world in flames. I wanted to join the side of peace and justice.
But you talk about yourself as having a longing to give yourself up to a cause. Could it have been another kind of cause? Could it have been a conservative cause? For
I doubt it, but who knows? I mean, I grew up in those times, and I think there's a very strong feeling among adolescents that they would like to belong to something larger. And the beautiful thing about growing up in the 60s was that something larger was defined by the civil rights movement.
My guest is Bill Ayers. His memoir, Fugitive Days, Memoirs of an Anti-War Activist, has been released in paperback by Beacon. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What was your campaign really all about, the bombing of the statues and the like? Was it to call attention to the cause? Do you think that it was that would have a positive effect in enlisting people?
You know, as I said, the people chose many different paths when it was clear that the war was going to escalate. And here was the context. 2,000 people every week murdered aimlessly, carelessly by our government. How do you call attention to it? How do you end it? Our own aspirations were not just to end this war, but to end the cause of war. So we thought of ourselves immodestly, I'm sure, as revolutionaries, but we wanted to transform society. Was this the right way to go about it? In this memoir, which is incidentally not a manifesto, not a history, I try to explain how one young man got caught up in that way, in that thinking, and acted on it. One of the great things about books, and you know because you're a person who reads books, is that it can set the context in a way that the soundbite culture never can.
But do you think that the protests and the riots in Chicago may have actually created a negative image of the anti-war movement for some people?
I don't think so.
People are afraid of anarchy.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I don't think so. I think, but again, I don't know how to draw a causal. I don't know how to make a causal claim about that. But no, I think people were exhausted from the war, and I think that the reason that that we didn't have more of an outpouring of protest in the early 70s is because the Nixon administration was very clever at stopping the ground war. The air war went on unrestricted, unrestrained, but bodies weren't coming home, and that took some of the heat out of the anti-war movement.
Well, you've written about bombing the police statue in Haymarket Square in Chicago twice, once in 1969 and then again in 1970. And Haymarket is a symbol on two sides of the political spectrum.
True.
For the left, it represented an important moment in the labor movement. For the right, it represented the beginning of terrorism in America.
Right. And the interesting thing is, again, that was a symbolic action. It was vandalism. I know what you're talking about. But I'm saying the bombing of the statue, of course, was vandalism and not anything like terrorism. But the first action in, what was it, 1885, 1886? That was a group of anarchists in Chicago demanding the eight-hour day. It's celebrated worldwide as May Day, but it started in Chicago.
But not in the United States. Because we consider that a negative
Exactly.
Experience.
But what happened in Chicago was that police fired into a crowd. Several people were killed. Someone threw a hand grenade or a bomb. But anarchists were rounded up and hanged. Albert Parsons, for one. And so it became a symbol of the repression of labor. And what did the city of Chicago do? They erected in the 20th century a statue of a police officer saying, "In the name of order, I command you halt." And as an act of vandalism, the organization that I co-founded knocked that statue over. People had been talking about knocking it over for decades, and we did it. And then they put it back up, and we knocked it over again. Now there is a lovely statue of workers holding a hay wagon, giving speeches from the hay wagon, and a plaque that really explains that history.
What were you making those bombs out of?
I have no idea, honestly. I think that I don't remember.
Were you improvising? Because, I mean, and in the light of what happened at the townhouse in Greenwich Village, obviously you must have been unaware of just how dangerous that sort of activity was.
Yeah, I think we were quite unaware, and I think we learned a dreadful lesson and tried to be careful. One of the things we did in the first years that we were underground is that we went around the country and tried to disarm and discourage people who were spontaneously doing the same thing. You may know, but between the years of 1970 and 73, there were something like 20,000 political bombings in the United States.
And you were on the FBI's most wanted.
My wife was. I was not. Bernadine Dorn was.
You write that each of you people in the Weather Underground took an alias, and that over time our given names became foreign to us and we hid from ourselves. How difficult was it to construct a new identity for yourself?
You know, I think it was we felt ourselves driven by a larger political and social purpose, and I think that we felt it was a necessity, and there were certainly senses of loss, but we had a community to hold on to, and I think it wasn't as difficult as one would imagine.
Where did you get the documentation? You had to get Social Security numbers.
Yeah, again, I write about that some. In those days, we learned how to go to various courthouses around the country and get death certificates, and from those death certificates, get birth certificates. And it was a kind of a small technical spy craft type thing. But we did it earnestly, and we did it consistently.
And you say that that this actually led you to develop your own culture and a weather look.
Yes, it's true. I mean, I think that's true of every group of people, every community. You develop a kind of a culture, and I try to have some fun with that in the book and talk about the kind of language that we develop, the kind of slang, the kind of way that if anybody – were knowledgeable about what we obsessed about, they could go into any one of our apartments and spot us in a minute by the books we read, by the food we ate, by the way we talked to one another.
Well, Mark Rudd has talked about that time as being kind of silly in some ways, that the attempts to get rid of sexism within the community sometimes took on really weird forms.
Yes. There was a lot of excess, a lot of irony, a lot of irreverence, and a lot of trying to invent things new from, you know, out of whole cloth. And so, sure, there was a lot of kind of nuttiness and silliness, but we were young and we were on a mission. The larger point is, of course, that the mission we were on was a mission to stop a murderous war and to support the right of African Americans to live free.
What was that weather look? Did you try to look straighter than anybody else on the left?
Not really. I think that we tried to look more hip in a certain way. I mean, we blended in with the youth culture pretty much, and we took ordinary jobs. We took jobs that people took who didn't have proper documentation. We worked in the fields in California. I worked in the shipyards. That was pretty typical.
At one point in the book, you describe your bombing campaign as an explosive narration. What did you mean by that? Were you just doing a wordplay?
I was doing a wordplay, but what I was saying is that we were trying to, as I said earlier, we're trying to raise a screaming objection to this war. We were trying to wake people up who perhaps had gone sleepwalking.
And what did you hope to accomplish when you bombed a Pentagon bathroom with 3 pounds of dynamite? Just to prove that you could get into the Pentagon?
It was partly a sense of wanting to penetrate what seemed impenetrable. It was partly a sense of wanting to take it into the headquarters. You know, we felt pretty strongly an identification with the victims of American power. So we were strongly identified with the Vietnamese, and we felt here we are, white privileged kids with access to everything, and what we ought to do is show that this power that thinks of itself as invincible is not invincible. And in fact, in Vietnam, the American military power exhausted itself. It could not win, and it did not win.
Well, throughout the memoir, you talk about the Vietnamese people and the poor as being more human than most people you knew at the time. What do you mean by that? How can someone be more human? Do you think you might have been romanticizing the plight?
Absolutely. It's intentionally a romanticization, and I write about that. We were romanticizing other people. No one can be more human than any other. But the point I was making is that that's kind of the way that we were drawn to these folks, was to see that people who had been made into devils, into one-dimensional characters, into objects, actually had all the dimensions that we did, and holding up their humanity, seeing that they had a name, a face, a mother and a father, people who cared about them, was a way of humanizing them and then humanizing ourselves.
People often ask why young people aren't protesting the war in Iraq the way they protested the war in Vietnam. The usual answer given is that there's no draft anymore. Do you think that's the real reason?
I mean, that could have something to do with it. Again, I'm reluctant to make any kind of causal claims, but I would say that what we witnessed in Iraq is very much the rhythm that we witnessed in Vietnam, and that is that it took the American people about 3 years to recognize that this illegal war was wrong, immoral, and should be stopped. I don't think we should expect or measure today's resistance by any standard that comes from 40 years ago. It'll have its own rhetoric. It'll have its own means. It'll have its own expressions.
Well, it did lead to the election of somebody who said that he would end the war.
And that's exactly right.
Unlike Richard Nixon, he may very well
end the war. You're exactly right, and I'm very hopeful about that.
But do you feel that you actually had, meaning the large group, had a real impact, that you really played a role in the ending of the war in Vietnam, or wouldn't it have wound down without all the bombings and the other stuff?
Well, I think the anti-war movement was a critically important, very humanizing aspect of American life in the 60s and 70s. But did we end the war? We did not. The war dragged on for 7 years after the American people opposed it. It went on for 10 years and was finally ended when the Vietnamese threw the Americans out.
When this book was published in 2001, right after September 11th, many reporters tried to contact you. What were they hoping to talk to you about?
Oh, I got several requests. I got a request to talk about how do people get false identification, how do people sneak into buildings, all kinds of things. And I wasn't interested in responding to any of that either. I didn't feel like I'm an expert on either tactics or spycraft. I'm a political person, and I'm interested in politics. I'm not interested in tactics.
Did you ever feel threatened after September 11th?
Yes.
Were people actually sending you threatening notes and stuff?
Yes, and they are now.
Well, I hope we get past that as well.
I hope so, too.
Bill Ayers' book, Fugitive Days, Memoirs of an Anti-War Activist, with a new afterword by the author, has been published in paperback now by Beacon. And I want to thank you, Bill Ayers, so much for being on our show today.
Thank you, Leonard. Great to see you.